12. It is by no means enough that an officer should be capable. He should be as well a gentleman of liberal education, refined manners, punctilious courtesy, and the nicest sense of personal honor. No meritorious act of the subordinate should escape his attention, even if the reward be only one word of approval. Conversely, he should not be blind to a single fault in any subordinate. True as may be the political principles for which we are now contending, the ships themselves must be ruled under a system of absolute despotism. I trust that I have now made clear to you the tremendous responsibilities. We must do the best we can with what we have. John Paul Jones, September 14, 1775. Excerpts from a letter to the Naval Committee of the North American Insurrectionists. The Roger Young was again returning to base for replacements, both capsules and men. Al Jenkins had bought his farm, covering a pickup. And that one had cost us the Padre, too. And besides that, I had to be replaced. I was wearing brand-new sergeant's chevrons, vice Migliaccio. But I had a hunch that Ace would be wearing them as soon as I was out of the ship. They were mostly honorary, I knew. The promotion was Jelly's way of giving me a good send-off, and I was detached for OCS. But it didn't keep me from being proud of them. At the fleet landing field, I went through the exit gate with my nose in the air and strode up to the quarantine desk to have my orders stamped. As this was being done, I heard a polite, respectful voice behind me. "Excuse me, Sergeant, but that boat that just came down, is it from the Roger..." I turned to see the speaker, flicked my eyes over his sleeves, saw that it was a small, slightly stooped-shouldered corporal, no doubt one of our... "Father?" Then the corporal had his arms around me. "Juan, Juan, oh my little Johnny." I kissed him and hugged him and started to cry. Maybe that civilian clerk at the quarantine desk had never seen two non-coms kiss each other before. Well, if I had noticed him so much as lifting an eyebrow, I would have pasted him. But I didn't notice him. I was busy. He had to remind me to take my orders with me. By then we had blown our noses and quit making an open spectacle of ourselves. I said, "Father, let's find a corner somewhere and sit down and talk. I want to know... well, everything." I took a deep breath. "I thought you were dead." "No. Came close to buying it once or twice, maybe. But son, Sergeant, I really do have to find out about that landing boat. You see..." "Oh, that? It's from the Roger Young. I just..." He looked terribly disappointed. "Then I've got to bounce right now. I've got to report in." Then he added eagerly, "But you'll be back aboard soon, won't you, Juanito? Are you going on R&R? No, I thought fast. Of all the ways to have things roll. "Look, Father, I know the boat schedule. You can't go aboard for at least an hour and a bit. That boat is not on a fast retrieve. She'll make a minimum fuel rendezvous when the Raj completes its pass. If the pilot doesn't have to wade over for the next pass after that. They've got to load first." He said dubiously, "My orders read to report at once to the pilot of the first available ship's boat." "Father, Father, do you have to be so confounded regulation? The girl who's pushing that heap won't care whether you're aboard the boat now or just as they button up. Anyhow, they'll play the ship's recall over the speakers in here 10 minutes before boost and announce it. You can't miss it." He let me lead him over to an empty corner. As we sat down, he added, "Will you be going up in the same boat, Juan, or later?" I showed him my orders. It seemed the simplest way to break the news. Ships that pass in the night, like the Evangeline story. Cripes. What a way for things to break. He read them and got tears in his eyes, and I said hastily, "Look, Father, I'm going to try to come back. I won't want any other outfit than the Roughnecks. I'm with you in them. Oh, I know it's disappointing, but it's not disappointment, Juan."
"Huh?"
"It's pride. My boy is going to be an officer. My little Johnny. Oh, it's disappointment, too. I'd waited for this day, but I can wait a little longer." He smiled through his tears. "You've grown, lad, and filled out, too."
"Oh, I guess so. But, Father, I'm not an officer yet, and I might be out of the Raj a few days. I mean, they sometimes bust 'em out pretty fast, and..."
"Enough of that, young man."
"Huh?"
"You'll make it. Let's have no more talk of busting out." Suddenly he smiled. "That's the first time I've been able to tell a sergeant to shut up."
"Well, I'll certainly try, Father. And if I do make it, I'll certainly put in for the old Raj. But..." I trailed off.
"Yes, I know. Your request won't mean anything unless there's a billet for you. Never mind. If this hour is all we have, we'll make the most of it. And I'm so proud of you, I'm splitting my seams. How have you been, Johnny?"
"Oh, fine. Just fine."
I wasn't thinking that it wasn't all bad. He would be better off in the Roughnecks than in any other outfit. All my friends, they take care of him. Keep him alive. I'd have to send a gram to Ace. Father, like as not, wouldn't even let them know he was related.
"Father, how long have you been in?"
"A little over a year."
"And corporal already?"
Father smiled grimly. "They're making them fast these days." I didn't have to ask what he meant. Casualties. There were always vacancies in the TO. You couldn't get enough trained soldiers to fill them. Instead, I said,
But Father, you're...
Well, I mean, aren't you sort of old to be soldiering? I mean, the Navy, or logistics, or..." "I wanted the MI, and I got it," he said emphatically. "And I'm no older than many sergeants. Not as old, in fact. Son, the mere fact that I am 22 years older than you are doesn't put me in a wheelchair. And age has its advantages, too." Well, there was something in that. I recall how Sergeant Zim had always tried the older men first, when he was dealing out boot chevrons. And Father would never have goofed in basic the way I had. No lashes for him. He was probably spotted as non-com material before he ever finished basic. The Army needs a lot of really grown-up men in the middle of grades. It's a paternalistic organization. I didn't have to ask him why he wanted MI, nor why or how he had wound up in my ship. I just felt warm about it, more flattered by it than any praise he had ever given me in words. And I didn't want to ask him why he had joined up. I felt that I knew. Mother. Neither of us had mentioned her. Too painful. So I changed the subject abruptly. "Bring me up to date. Tell me where you've been and what you've done."
"Well, I trained at Camp St. Martin."
"Huh? Not Curie?"
"New one. But the same old lumps, I understand. Only they rush you through 2 months faster. You don't get Sundays off. Then I requested the Roger Young, and didn't get it, and wound up in McSlattery's Volunteers. A good outfit."
"Yes, I know. They had had a reputation for being rough, tough, and nasty. Almost as good as the Roughnecks." "I should say that it was a good outfit. I made several drops with them, and some of the boys bought it, and after a while I got these." He glanced at his chevrons. "I was a corporal when we dropped in Sheol."
"You were there?"
"So was I." With a sudden warm flood of emotion, I felt closer to my father than I ever had before in my life.
"I know. At least I knew your outfit was there. I was about 50 miles north of you, near as I can guess. We soaked up that counterattack when they came boiling up out of the ground like bats out of a cave. Father shrugged. So when it was over, I was a corporal without an outfit. Not enough of us left to make a healthy cadre. So they sent me here. I could have gone with King's Kodiak Bears, but I had a word with the replacement sergeant, and sure as sunrise, the Roger Young came back with a billet for a corporal. So here I am. And when did you join up? I realized that it was the wrong remark as soon as I had made it. But I had to get the subject away from McSlattery's volunteers. An orphan from a dead outfit wants to forget it. Father said quietly, shortly after Buenos Aires. Oh, I see. Father didn't say anything for several moments. Then he said softly, I'm not sure that you do see, son. Sir? It will not be easy to explain. Certainly losing your mother had a great deal to do with it. But I didn't enroll to avenge her, even though I had that in mind, too. You had more to do with it.
Me?
Yes, you. Son, I've always understood that you were doing better than your mother did. Don't blame her. She never had a chance to know, any more than a bird can understand swimming. And perhaps I knew why you did it, even though I beg to doubt that you knew yourself at the time. At least half of my anger at you was sheer resentment, that you had actually done something that I knew, buried deep in my heart, I should have done. But you weren't the cause of my joining up either. You merely helped trigger it, and you did control the service I chose. He paused. I wasn't in good shape at the time you enrolled. I was seeing my hypnotherapist pretty regularly. You never suspected that, did you? But we had gotten no farther than a clear recognition that I was enormously dissatisfied. After you left, I took it out on you. But it was not you. And I knew it, and my therapist knew it. I suppose I knew that there was real trouble brewing earlier than most. We were invited to bid on military components fully a month before the state of emergency was announced. We had converted almost entirely to war production while you were still in training. I felt better during that period, worked to death and too busy to see my therapist. Then I became more troubled than ever. He smiled. Son, do you know about civilians?
Well, we don't talk the same language, I know that.
Clearly enough put. Do you remember Madame Rutman? I was on a few days' leave after I finished basic, and I went home. I saw some of our friends, said goodbye, she among them. She chattered away and said, So you're really going out? Well, if you reach far away, you really must look up my dear friends, the Regatos. I told her as gently as I could that it seemed highly unlikely since the arachnids had occupied Faraway. It didn't seem to faze her in the least. She said, Oh, that's all right. They're civilians. Father smiled cynically. Yes, I know. But I'm getting ahead of my story. I told you that I was getting still more upset. Your mother's death released me for what I had to do, even though she and I were closer than most. Nevertheless, it set me free to do it. I turned the business over to Morales.
Old man Morales? Can he handle it?
Yes, because he has to. A lot of us are doing things we didn't know we could. I gave him a nice chunk of stock. You know the old saying about the kind that tread the grain? The rest, I split two ways, in a trust, half to the Daughters of Charity, half to you, whenever you want to go back and take it. If you do. Never mind. I had at last found out what was wrong with me. He stopped, then said very softly, I had to perform an act of faith. I had to prove to myself that I was a man, not just a producing, consuming,
economic animal, but a man. At that moment, before I could answer anything, the wall speakers around us sang, shines the name of Roger Young. And a girl's voice added, personnel for FCT Roger Young, stand to boat, berth H, 9 minutes. Father bounced to his feet, grabbed his kit roll. That's mine. Take care of yourself, son, and hit those exams, or you'll find you're still not too big to paddle. I will, Father. He embraced me hastily. See you when we get back. And he was gone, on the bounce. In the Commandant's outer office, I reported to a fleet sergeant who looked remarkably like Sergeant Ho, even to lacking an arm. However, he lacked Sergeant Ho's smile as well. I said, Career Sergeant Juan Rico, to report to the Commandant, pursuant to orders. He glanced at the clock. Your boat was down 73 minutes ago. Well? So I told him. He pulled his lip and looked at me meditatively. I've heard every excuse in the book, but you've just added a new page. Your father, your own father, really was reporting to your old ship just as you were detached. The bare truth, Sergeant. You can check it. Corporal Emilio Rico. We don't check the statements of the young gentlemen around here. We simply cashier them if it ever turns out that they have not told the truth. Okay, a boy who wouldn't be late in order to see his old man off wouldn't be worth much in any case. Forget it. Thanks, Sergeant. Do I report to the Commandant now? You've reported to him. He made a check mark on a list. Maybe a month from now he'll send for you along with a couple of dozen others. Here's your room assignment. Here's a checkoff list you start with. And you can start by cutting off those chevrons, but save them. You may need them later. But as of this moment, you are Mister, not Sergeant. Yes, sir. Don't call me sir. I call you sir. But you won't like it. I am not going to describe Officer Candidate School. It's like basic, but squared and cubed, with books added. In the mornings, we behaved like privates, doing the same old things we had done in basic and in combat, and being chewed out for the way we did them by sergeants. In the afternoons, we were cadets and gentlemen, and recited on and were lectured concerning an endless list of subjects: math, science, galactography, xenology, hypnopedia, logistics, strategy, and tactics, communications, military law, terrain reading, special weapons, psychology of leadership, anything from the caring and feeding of privates to why Xerxes lost the big one. Most especially, how to be a one-man catastrophe yourself while keeping track of 50 other men, nursing them, loving them, leading them, saving them, but never babying them. We had beds, which we used all too little. We had rooms and showers and inside plumbing, and each 4 candidates had a civilian servant to make our beds and clean our rooms and shine our shoes and lay out our uniforms and run errands. This service was not intended as a luxury and was not. Its purpose was to give the student more time to accomplish the plainly impossible by relieving him of things any graduate of basic can already do perfectly. 6 days shalt thou work and do all thou art able, the 7th the same, and pound on the cable. Or the army version ends, and clean out the stable, which shows you how many centuries this sort of thing has been going on. I wish I could catch just one of those civilians who think we loaf and put them through 1 month of OCS. In the evenings and all-day Sundays, we studied until our eyes burned and our ears ached, then slept, if we slept, with a hypnopedic speaker droning away under the pillow. Our marching songs were appropriately downbeat. No army for mine, no army for mine. I'd rather be behind the plow any old time. And don't want to study war no more. And don't make my boy a soldier, the weeping mother cried. And favorite of all, the old classic, Gentlemen Rankers, with its chorus about the little lost sheep. God have pity on such as we. Ba, ya, ba. Yet somehow, I don't remember being unhappy. Too busy, I guess. There was never that psychological hump to get over. The one everybody hits in basic. There was simply the ever-present fear of flunking out. My poor preparation in math bothered me especially. My roommate, a colonial from Hesperus, with the oddly appropriate name of Angel, sat up night after night tutoring me. Most of the instructors, especially the officers, were disabled. The only ones I can remember who had a full complement of arms, legs, eyesight, hearing, etc., were some of the non-commissioned combat instructors, and not all of those. Our coach in dirty fighting sat in a powered chair, wearing a plastic collar, and was completely paralyzed from the neck down. But his tongue wasn't paralyzed. His eye was photographic, and the savage way in which he could analyze and criticize what he had seen made up for his minor impediment. At first, I wondered why these obvious candidates for physical retirement and full pay pension didn't take it and go home. Then I quit wondering. I guess the high point of my whole cadet course was a visit from Ensign Ibanez. She of the dark eyes, junior watch officer and pilot under instruction of the corvette transport Mannerheim. Carmencita showed up, looking incredibly pert in navy dress whites and about the size of a paperweight, while my class was lined up for evening meal muster, walked down the line, and you could hear eyeballs click as she passed, walked straight up to the duty officer and asked for me by name in a clear, penetrating voice. The duty officer, Captain Shandar, was widely believed never to have smiled at his own mother. But he smiled down at little Carmen, straining his face out of shape, and admitted my existence. Whereupon she waved her long black lashes at him, explained that her ship was about to boost, and could she please take me out to dinner. I found myself in possession of a highly irregular and totally unprecedented 3-hour pass. It may be that the Navy has developed hypnosis techniques that they have not yet gotten around to passing on to the Army. Or her secret weapon may be older than that, and not usable by MI. In any case, I not only had a wonderful time, but my prestige with my classmates, none too high until then, climbed to amazing heights. It was a glorious evening, and well worth flunking 2 classes the next day. It was somewhat dimmed by the fact that we had each heard about Carl, killed when the bugs smashed our research station on Pluto. But only somewhat, as we had each learned to live with such things. One thing did startle me. Carmen relaxed and took off her hat while we were eating, and her blue-black hair was all gone. I knew that a lot of Navy girls shaved their heads. After all, it's not practical to take care of long hair in a warship, and, most especially, a pilot can't risk having her hair floating around, getting in the way, in any free-fall maneuvers. Shucks, I shaved my own scalp just for convenience and cleanliness. But my mental picture of Carmen included this mane of thick, wavy hair. But, do you know, once you get used to it, it's rather cute. I mean, if a girl looks all right to start with, she still looks all right with her head smooth. And it does serve to set a Navy girl apart from civilian chicks. Sort of a lodge pin, like the gold skulls for combat drops. It made Carmen look distinguished, gave her dignity. And for the first time, I fully realized
that she really was an officer and a fighting man, as well as a very pretty girl. I got back to barracks with stars in my eyes and whiffing slightly of perfume. Carmen had kissed me goodbye. The only OCS classroom course, the content of which I'm even going to mention, was history and moral philosophy. I was surprised to find it in the curriculum. H and MP has nothing to do with combat and how to lead a platoon. Its connection with war, where it is connected, is in why to fight, a matter already settled for any candidate long before he reaches OCS. An MI fights because he is MI. I decided that the course must be a repeat, for the benefit of those of us, maybe a third, who had never had it in school. Over 20% of my cadet class were not from Terra, a much higher percentage of colonials signed up to serve than do people born on Earth. Sometimes it makes you wonder. And of the 3/4 or so from Terra, some were from associated territories or other places where H and MP might not be taught, so I figured it for a cinch course, which would give me a little rest from tough courses, the ones with decimal points. Wrong again. Unlike my high school course, you had to pass it. Not by examination, however. The course included examinations and prepared papers and quizzes and such. But no marks. What you had to have was the instructor's opinion that you were worthy of commission. If he gave you a down check, a board sat on you, questioning not merely whether you could be an officer, but whether you belonged in the army at any rank. No matter how fast you might be with weapons, deciding whether to give you extra instruction or just kick you out and let you be a civilian. History and moral philosophy works like a delayed action bomb. You wake up in the middle of the night and think, now what did he mean by that? That had been true even with my high school course. I simply hadn't known what Colonel Dubois was talking about. When I was a kid, I thought it was silly for the course to be in the science department. It was nothing like physics or chemistry. Why wasn't it over in the fuzzy studies where it belonged? The only reason I paid attention was because there were such lovely arguments. I had no idea that Mr. Dubois was trying to teach me why to fight until long after I had decided to fight anyhow. Well, why should I fight? Wasn't it preposterous to expose my tender skin to the violence of unfriendly strangers, especially as the pay at any rank was barely spending money, the hours terrible, and the working conditions worse? When I could be sitting at home while such matters were handled by thick-skulled characters who enjoyed such games? Particularly when the strangers against whom I fought never had done anything to me personally until I showed up and started kicking over their tea wagon. What sort of nonsense is this? Fight because I'm MI? Brother, you're drooling like Dr. Pavlov's dogs. Cut it out and start thinking. Major Reed, our instructor, was a blind man with a disconcerting habit of looking straight at you and calling you by name. We were reviewing events after the war between the Russo-Anglo-American Alliance and the Chinese hegemony, 1987 and following. But this was the day that we heard the news of the destruction of San Francisco and the San Joaquin Valley. I thought he would give us a pep talk. After all, even a civilian ought to be able to figure it out now. The bugs or us. Fight or die. Major Reed didn't mention San Francisco. He had one of us apes summarize the negotiated treaty of New Delhi, discuss how it ignored prisoners of war, and, by implication, dropped the subject forever. The armistice became a stalemate, and prisoners stayed where they were, on one side. On the other side, they were turned loose and, during the disorders, made their way home. Or not, if they didn't want to. Major Reed's victims summed up the unreleased prisoners. Survivors of 2 divisions of British paratroopers, some thousands of civilians, captured mostly in Japan, the Philippines, and Russia, and sentenced for political crimes. Besides that, there were many other military prisoners, Major Reed's victim went on, captured during and before the war. There were rumors that some had been captured in the earlier war and never released. The total of unreleased prisoners was never known. The best estimates place the number around 65,000.
Why the best?
That's the estimate in the textbook, sir. Please be precise in your language. Was the number greater or less than 100,000?
I don't know, sir.
And nobody else knows.
Was it greater than 1,000?
Probably, sir. Almost certainly.
Utterly certain, because more than that eventually escaped, found their ways home, were tallied by name.
I can see you did not read your lesson carefully.
Mr. Rico?
Now I am the victim.
Yes, sir.
Are 1,000 unreleased prisoners sufficient reason to start or resume a war? Bear in mind that millions of innocent people may die, almost certainly will die, if a war is started or resumed.
I didn't hesitate. Yes, sir. More than enough reason.
More than enough.
Very well. Is one prisoner, unreleased by the enemy, enough reason to start or resume a war?
I hesitated. I knew the MI answer, but I didn't think that was the one he wanted.
He said sharply, Come, mister. We have an upper limit of 1,000. I invited you to consider a lower limit of 1. But you can't pay a promissory note which reads somewhere between 1 and 1,000 pounds. And starting a war is much more serious than paying a trifle of money.
Wouldn't it be criminal to endanger a country, 2 countries in fact, to save 1 man? Especially as he may not deserve it, or may die in the meantime? Thousands of people get killed every day in accidents, so why hesitate over 1 man?
Answer. Answer yes or answer no. You're holding up the class.
He got my goat. I gave him the cap trooper's answer.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
What?
It doesn't matter whether it's 1,000 or just 1, sir. You fight.
Aha. The number of prisoners is irrelevant.
Good. Now prove your answer.
I was stuck. I knew it was the right answer, but I didn't know why. He kept hounding me.
Speak up, Mr. Rico. This is an exact science. You have made a mathematical statement. You must give proof. Someone may claim that you have asserted, by analogy, that 1 potato is worth the same price, no more, no less, as 1,000 potatoes.
No?
No, sir.
Why not? Prove it.
Men are not potatoes.
Good. Good, Mr. Rico. I think we have strained your tired brain enough for one day.
Bring to class tomorrow a written proof in symbolic logic of your answer to my original question. I'll give you a hint. See reference 7 in today's chapter.
Mr. Solomon,
how did the present political organization evolve out of the disorders, and what is its moral justification?
Sally stumbled through the first part. However, nobody can describe accurately how the Federation came about. It just grew. With national governments in collapse at the end of the 20th century, something had to fill the vacuum, and in many cases, it was returned veterans. They had lost to war. Most of them had no jobs. Many were sore as could be over the terms of the Treaty of New Delhi, especially the POW foul-up. And they knew how to fight. But it wasn't revolution. It was more like what happened in Russia in 1917. The system collapsed. Somebody else moved in. The first known case in Aberdeen, Scotland, was typical. Some veterans got together as vigilantes to stop rioting and looting, hanged a few people, including 2 veterans, and decided not to let anyone but veterans on their committee. Just arbitrary at first. They trusted each other a bit. They didn't trust anyone else. What started as an emergency measure became constitutional practice.
in a generation or two. Probably those Scottish veterans, since they were finding it necessary to hang some veterans, decided that if they had to do this, they weren't going to let any bleeding, profiteering, black market, double time for overtime, army dodging, unprintable civilians have any say about it. They'd do what they were told, see, while us apes straightened things out. That's my guess, because I might feel the same way. The historians agree that antagonism between civilians and returned soldiers was more intense than we can imagine today. Sally didn't tell it by the book. Finally, Major Reed cut him off. "Bring a summary to class tomorrow, 3,000 words. Mr. Solomon, can you give me a reason, not historical nor theoretical, but practical, why the franchise is today limited to discharged veterans?" Because they are picked men, sir? Smarter?
Preposterous.
Sir? Is the word too long for you? I said it was a silly notion. Servicemen are not brighter than civilians. In many cases, civilians are much more intelligent. That was the sliver of justification underlying the attempted coup d'etat just before the Treaty of New Delhi, the so-called revolt of the scientists. Let the intelligent elite run things and you'll have utopia. It fell flat on its foolish face, of course, because the pursuit of science, despite its social benefits, is not a social virtue. Its practitioners can be men so self-centered as be lacking in social responsibility. I've given you a hint, mister. Can you pick it up? Sally answered, Servicemen are disciplined, sir? Major Reed was gentle with him. Sorry. An appealing theory not backed up by facts. You and I are not permitted to vote as long as we remain in the service. Nor is it verifiable that military discipline makes a man self-disciplined once he is out. The crime rate of veterans is much like that of civilians. And you have forgotten that in peacetime, most veterans come from non-combat auxiliary services and have not been subjected to the full rigors of military discipline. They have merely been harried, overworked, and endangered. Yet their votes count. Major Reed smiled. Mr. Solomon, I handed you a trick question. The practical reason for continuing our system is the same as the practical reason for continuing anything. It works satisfactorily. Nevertheless, it is instructive to observe the details. Throughout history, men have labored to place the sovereign franchise in hands that would guard it well and use it wisely, for the benefit of all. An early attempt was absolute monarchy, passionately defended as the divine right of kings. Sometimes attempts were made to select a wise monarch, rather than leave it up to God, as when the Swedes picked a Frenchman, General Bernadotte, to rule them. The objection to this is that the supply of Bernadottes is limited. Historic examples range from absolute monarch to utter anarch. Mankind has tried thousands of ways, and many more have been proposed. Some weird in the extreme, such as the ant-like communism urged by Plato under the misleading title The Republic. But the intent has always been moralistic, to provide stable and benevolent government. All systems seek to achieve this by limited franchise to those who are believed to have the wisdom to use it justly. I repeat, all systems, even the so-called unlimited democracies, excluded from franchise not less than 1/4 of their populations by age, birth, poll tax, criminal record, or other. Major Reed smiled cynically. I have never been able to see how a 30-year-old moron can vote more wisely than a 15-year-old genius. But that was the age of the divine right of the common man. Never mind. They paid for their folly. The sovereign franchise has been bestowed by all sorts of rules. Place of birth, family of birth, race, sex, property, education, age, religion, etc.
All these systems worked, and none of them well. All were regarded as tyrannical by many. All eventually collapsed, or were overthrown. Now here we are with still another system, and our system works quite well. Many complain, but none rebel. Personal freedom for all is greatest in history. Laws are few, taxes are low. Living standards are as high as productivity permits. Crime is at its lowest ebb. Why? Not because our voters are smarter than other people. We've deposed of that argument. Mr. Tammany, can you tell us why our system works better than any used by our ancestors? I don't know where Clyde Tammany got his name. I'd take him for a Hindu. He answered, I'd venture to guess that it's because the electors are a small group who know that the decisions are up to them, so they study the issues. No guessing, please. This is exact science. And your guess is wrong. The ruling nobles of many another system were a small group fully aware of their grave power. Furthermore, our franchised citizens are not everywhere a small franchise. You know, or should know, that the percentage of citizens among adults ranges from over 80% on Iskander to less than 3% in some Terran nations. Yet government is much the same everywhere. Nor are the voters picked men. They bring no special wisdom, talent, or training to their sovereign tasks. So what difference is there between our voters and wielders of franchise in the past? We have had enough guesses. I'll state the obvious. Under our system, every voter and office holder is a man who has demonstrated through voluntary and difficult service that he places the welfare of the group ahead of personal advantage. And that is the one practical difference. He may fail in wisdom, he may lapse in civic virtue, but his average performance is enormously better than that of any other class of rulers in history. Major Reed paused to touch the face of an old-fashioned watch, reading its hands. The period is almost over, and we have yet to determine the moral reason for our success in governing ourselves. Now, continued success is never a matter of chance. Bear in mind that this is science, not wishful thinking. The universe is what it is, not what we want it to be. To vote is to wield authority. It is the supreme authority from which all other authority derives, such as mine, to make your lives miserable once a day. Force, if you will, the franchise is force, naked and raw, the power of the rods and the axe. Whether it is exerted by 10 men or 10 billion, political authority is force. But this universe consists of paired dualities. What is the converse of authority? Mr. Rico? He had picked one I could answer. Responsibility, sir. Applause. Both for practical reasons and for mathematically verifiable moral reasons, authority and responsibility must be equal. Else a balancing takes place as surely as current flows between points of unequal potential. To permit irresponsible authority is to sow disaster. To hold a man responsible for anything he does not control is to behave with blind idiocracy. The unlimited democracies were unstable because their citizens were not responsible for the fashion in which they exerted their sovereign authority, other than through the tragic logic of history. The unique poll tax that we must pay was unheard of. No attempt was made to determine whether a voter was socially responsible to the extent of his literally unlimited authority. If he voted the impossible, the disastrous possible happened instead. And responsibility was then forced on him willy-nilly and destroyed both him and his foundationless temple. Superficially, our system is only slightly different. We have democracy unlimited by race, color, creed, birth, wealth, sex, or conviction, And anyone may win sovereign power by a usually short and not too arduous term of service. Nothing more than a light workout to our caveman ancestors. But that slight difference is one between a system that works, since it is constructed to match the facts, and one that is inherently unstable. Since sovereign franchise is the ultimate in human authority, we ensure that all who wield it accept the ultimate in social responsibility. We require each person who wishes to exert control over the state to wager his own life, and lose it, if need be, to save the life of the state. The maximum responsibility a human can accept is thus equated to the ultimate authority a human can exert. Yin and yang, perfect and equal. The Major added, Can anyone define why there has never been revolution against our system, despite the fact that every government in history has had such? Despite the notorious fact that complaints are loud and unceasing? One of the older cadets took a crack at it. So revolution is impossible. Yes, but why? Because revolution, armed uprising, requires not only dissatisfaction, but aggressiveness. A revolutionist has to be willing to fight and die, or he's just a parlor pink. If you separate out the aggressive ones and make them the sheepdogs, the sheep will never give you trouble. Nicely put. Analogy is always suspect, but that one is close to the facts. Bring me a mathematical proof tomorrow. Time for one more question. You ask it, and I'll answer. Anyone? Sir, why not go the limit? Require everyone to serve and let everybody vote. Young man, can you restore my eyesight? Sir? Why, no, sir. You would find it much easier than to instill moral virtue, social responsibility, into a person who doesn't have it, doesn't want it, and resents having the burden thrust on him. This is why we make it so hard to enroll, so easy to resign. Social responsibility above the level of family, or at the most, of tribe, requires imagination, devotion, loyalty, all the higher virtues which a man must develop himself. If he has them forced down him, he will vomit them out. Conscript armies have been tried in the past. Look up in the library the psychiatric report on brainwashed prisoners in the so-called Korean War circa 1950. The Mayer Report. Bring an analysis to class. He touched his watch. Dismissed. Major Reed gave us a busy time. But it was interesting. I caught one of those master's thesis assignments he chucked around so casually. I had suggested that the Crusades were different from most wars. I got sawed off and handed this. Required to prove that war and moral perfection derive from the same genetic inheritance. Briefly thus, all wars arise from populist pressure. Yes, even the Crusades, though you have to dig into trade routes and birth rate and several other things to prove it. Morals, all correct moral rules, derive from the instinct to survive. Moral behavior is survival behavior above the individual level, as in a father who dies to save his children. But since population pressure results from the process of surviving through others, then war, because it results from population pressure, derives from the same inherent instinct which produces all moral rules suitable for human beings. Check of proof. Is it possible to abolish war by relieving population pressure, and thus do away with the all-too-evident evils of war, through constructing a moral code under which population is limited to resources? Without debating the usefulness or morality of Planned Parenthood, it may be verified by observation that any breed which stops its own increase gets crowded out by breeds which expand. Some human populations did so, in Terran history, and other breeds moved in and engulfed them. Nevertheless, Let's assume that the human race manages to balance birth and death just right to fit its own planet, and thereby becomes peaceful. What happens? Soon, about next Wednesday, the bugs move in, kill off this breed which ain't a-gonna study war no more, and the universe forgets us. Which still may happen. Either we spread and wipe out the bugs, or they spread and wipe us out. Because both races are tough and smart, and want the same real estate. Do you know how fast population pressure can cause us to fill the entire universe shoulder to shoulder? The answer will astound you. Just the flicker of an eye in terms of the age of our race. Try it. It's a compound interest expansion. But does man have any right to spread through the universe? Man is what he is, a wild animal with a will to survive, and, so far, the ability, against all competition. Unless one accepts that, anything one says about morals, war, politics, you name it, is nonsense. Correct morals arise from knowing what man is, not what do-gooders and well-meaning old Aunt Nellies would like him to be. The universe will let us know, later, whether or not man has any right to expand through it. In the meantime, the MI will be in there, on the bounce and swinging, on the side of our own race. Toward the end, each of us was shipped out to serve under an experienced combat commander. This was a semi-final examination. Your board ship instructor could decide that you didn't have what it takes. You could demand a board, but I never heard of anybody who did. They either came back with an upcheck, or we never saw them again. Some hadn't failed. It was just that they were killed, because assignments were to ships about to go into action. We were required to keep kit bags packed. Once, at lunch, all the cadet officers of my company were tapped. They left without eating, and I found myself cadet company commander. Like boot chevrons, this is an uncomfortable honor, but in less than 2 days, my own call came. I bounced down to the commandant's office, kit bag over my shoulder and feeling grand. I was sick of late hours and burning eyes and never catching up, of looking stupid in class. A few weeks in the cheerful company of a combat team was just what Johnny needed. I passed some new cadets, trotting to class in close formation, each with the grim look that every OCS candidate gets when he realizes that possibly he made a mistake in bucking for officer. And I found myself singing. I shut up when I was within earshot of the office. Two others were there, cadets Hassan and Bird. Hassan, the assassin, was the oldest man in our class, and looked like something a fisherman had let out of a bottle, while Birdie wasn't much bigger than a sparrow, and about as intimidating. We were ushered into the Holy of Holies. The commandant was in his wheelchair. We never saw him out of it except Saturday inspection and parade. I guess walking hurt. But that didn't mean you didn't see him. You could be working a prob at the board, turn around, and find that wheelchair behind you, and Colonel Nielsen reading your mistakes. He never interrupted. There was a standing order not to shout attention. But it's disconcerting. There seemed to be about six of him. The commandant had a permanent rank of fleet general. Yes, that Nielsen. His rank as colonel was temporary, pending second retirement, to permit him to be commandant. I once questioned a paymaster about this and confirmed what the regulations seemed to say. The commandant got only the pay of a colonel, but would revert to the pay of a fleet general on the day he decided to retire again. Well, as A says, it takes all sorts. I can't imagine choosing half pay for the privilege of riding herd on cadets. Colonel Nielsen looked up and said, "Morning, gentlemen. Make yourselves comfortable." I sat down, but wasn't comfortable. He glided over to the coffee machine, drew four cups, and Hassan helped him deal them out.
I didn't want coffee, but a cadet doesn't refuse the Commandant's hospitality.
He took a sip.
I have your orders, gentlemen, he announced, and your temporary commissions.
He went on.
But I want to be sure you understand your status.
We had already been lectured about this. We were going to be officers just enough for instruction and testing. Supernumerary, probationary, and temporary.
Very junior, quite superfluous, on good behavior, and extremely temporary.
We would revert to cadet when we got back, and could be busted at any time by the officers examining us.
We would be temporary third lieutenants, a rank as necessary as feet on a fish, wedged into the hairline between fleet sergeants and real officers. It is as low as you can get and still be called an officer.
If anybody ever saluted a third lieutenant, the light must have been bad.
Your commission reads third lieutenant, he went on, but your pay stays the same. You continue to be addressed as Mr. The only change in uniform is a shoulder pip even smaller than cadet insignia. You continue under instruction, since it has not been yet settled that you are fit to be officers.
The colonel smiled.
So why call you a third lieutenant?
I had wondered about that. Why this whoop-de-doo of commissions that weren't real commissions?
Of course I knew the textbook answer.
Mr. Bird, the commandant said.
To place us in the line of command, sir?
Exactly.
Colonel glided to a TO on one wall. It was the usual pyramid, with chain of command defined all the way down.
Look at this. He pointed at a box connected to his own by a horizontal line. It read, Assistant to Commandant, Miss Kendrick.
Gentlemen, he went on, I would have trouble running this place without Miss Kendrick. Her head is a rapid access file to everything that happens around here. He touched a control on his chair and spoke to the air. Miss Kendrick, what mark did Cadet Bird receive in military law last term?
Her answer came back at once. 93%, Commandant.
Thank you.
He continued.
You see? I sign anything if Miss Kendrick has initialed it. I would hate to have an investigating committee find out how often she signs my name, and I don't even see it.
Tell me, Mr. Bird, if I drop dead, does Miss Kendrick carry on to keep things moving?
Birdie looked puzzled.
I suppose with routine matters, she would do what was necessary.
She wouldn't do a blessed thing,
the colonel thundered, until Colonel Chauncey told her what to do. His way. She is a very smart woman and understands what you apparently do not, namely, that she is not in the line of command and has no authority.
He went on.
Line of command isn't just a phrase. It's as real as a slap in the face. If I ordered you to combat as a cadet, the most you could do would be to pass along somebody else's orders. If your platoon leader bought it, and you then gave an order to a private, a good order, sensible and wise, you would be wrong, and he would be just as wrong if he obeyed it. Because a cadet cannot be in the line of command. A cadet has no military existence, no rank, and is not a soldier. He is a student who will become a soldier, either an officer or at his former rank. While he is under army discipline, he is not in the army. That is why...
A zero. A knot with no rim. If a cadet wasn't even in the army...
Colonel?
Hey, speak up, young man. Mr. Rico.
I had startled myself, but I had to say it.
But if we aren't in the army, then we aren't MI, sir.
He blinked at me.
This worries you?
I don't believe I like that much, sir.
I didn't like it at all. I felt naked. I see. He didn't seem displeased.
You let me worry about the space lawyer aspects of it, son.
But
that's an order. You are technically not an MI. But the MI hasn't forgotten you. The MI never forgets its own, no matter where they are. If you are struck dead this instant, you will be cremated as Second Lieutenant Juan Rico, Mobile Infantry of...
Colonel Nielsen stopped.
Miss Kendrick, what was Mr. Rico's ship?
The Roger Young.
Thank you.
He added,
In and of TFCT Roger Young, assigned to Mobile Combat Team 2nd Platoon of George Company 3rd Regiment 1st Division MI. The Roughnecks, he recited with relish, not consulting anything once he had been reminded of my ship.
A good outfit, Mr. Rico. Proud and nasty.
Your final orders go back to them for taps, and that's the way your name will read in Memorial Hall. That's why we always commission a dead cadet, son, so we can send him home to his mates.
I felt a surge of relief and homesickness and missed a few words.
Lipped button while I talk. We'll have you back in the MI where you belong. You must be temporary officers for your apprentice crews, because there is no room for deadheads in a combat drop. You'll fight and take orders and give orders. Legal orders, because you will hold rank and be ordered to serve in that team. That makes any order you give in carrying out your assigned duties as binding as one signed by the CNC. Even more, the commandant went on, once you are in line of command, you must be ready instantly to assume higher command. If you are in a one platoon team, quite likely in the present state of the war, and you are assistant platoon leader when your platoon leader buys it, then you are it. He shook his head. Not acting platoon leader, not a cadet leading a drill, not a junior officer under instruction. Suddenly you are the old man, the boss, commanding officer present, and you discover with a sickening shock that fellow human beings are depending on you alone to tell them what to do, how to fight, how to complete the mission and get out alive. They wait for the sure voice of command, while seconds trickle away, and it's up to you to be that voice, make decisions, give the right orders, and not only the right ones, but in a calm, unworried tone. Because it's a cinch, gentlemen, that your team is in trouble, bad trouble. And a strange voice with panic in it can turn the best combat team in the galaxy into a leaderless, lawless, fear-crazed mob. The whole merciless load will land without warning. You must act at once, and you'll have only God over you. Don't expect him to fill in tactical details. That's your job. He'll be doing all that a soldier has a right to expect, if he helps you keep the panic that you are sure to feel out of your voice. The colonel paused. I was sobered, and Birdie was looking terribly serious and awfully young, and Hassan was scowling. I wished that I were back in the drop room of the Raj, with not too many chevrons and an after-chow bull session in full swing. There was a lot to be said for the job of assistant section leader. When you come right to it, it's a lot easier to die than it is to use your head. The commandant continued. That's the moment of truth, gentlemen. Regrettably, there is no method known to military science to tell a real officer from a glib imitation with pips on his shoulders, other than through ordeal by fire. Real ones come through, or die, gallantly. Imitations crack up. Sometimes, in cracking up, the misfits die. But the tragedy lies in the loss of others. Good men, sergeants and corporals and privates, whose only lack is fatal bad fortune in finding themselves under the command of an incompetent. We try to avoid this. First is our unbreakable rule that every cadet must be a trained trooper, bloodied under fire, a veteran of combat drops.
No other army in history has stuck to this rule, although some have come close. Most great military schools of the past, Saint-Cyr, West Point, Sandhurst, Colorado Springs, don't even pretend to follow it. They accepted civilian boys, trained them, commissioned them, sent them out with no battle experience to command men, and sometimes discover too late that this smart young officer was a fool, a poltroon, or a hysteric. At least we have no misfits of those sorts. We know you are good soldiers, brave and skilled, proved in battle. Else you would not be here. We know that your intelligence and education meet acceptable minimums. With this to start on, we eliminate as many as possible of the not quite competent. Get them quickly back in ranks before we spoil good cap troopers by forcing them beyond their abilities. The course is very hard, because what will be expected of you later is still harder. In time, we have a small group whose chances look fairly good. The major criterion left untested is one we cannot test here. That undefinable something, which is the difference between a leader in battle and one who merely has the earmarks, but not the vocation. So we field test for it. Gentlemen, you have reached that point. Are you ready to take the oath? There was an instant of silence. Then Hassan, the assassin, answered firmly, "Yes, Colonel," and Bertie and I echoed. The Colonel frowned. "I have been telling you how wonderful you are. Physically perfect, mentally alert, trained, disciplined, bloodied. The very model of the smart young officer." He snorted. "Nonsense. You may become officers someday. I hope so. We not only hate to waste money and time and effort, but also, and much more important, I shiver in my boots every time I send one of you half-baked, not-quite officers up to the fleet, knowing what a Frankensteinian monster I may be turning loose on a good combat team. If you understood what you're up against, you wouldn't be so all-fired ready to take the oath the second the question is put to you. You may turn it down and force me to let you go back to your permanent ranks, but you don't know. So I'll try once more. Mr. Rico, have you ever thought how it would feel to be court-martialed for losing a regiment?" I was startled silly. "Why, no, sir, I never have." "To be court-martialed, for any reason, is 8 times as bad for an officer as for an enlisted man. Offenses which will get privates kicked out, maybe with lashes, possibly without, rate death in an officer. Better never to have been born." "Think about it," he said grimly. "When I suggested that your platoon leader might be killed, I was by no means citing the ultimate in military disaster. Mr. Hassan, what is the largest number of command levels ever knocked out in a single battle?" The assassin scowled harder than ever. "I'm not sure, sir. Wasn't there a while during Operation Buckhouse when a major commanded a brigade before the Sauve qui peut?" "There was, and his name was Fredericks. He got a decoration and a promotion. If you go back to the Second Global War, you can find a case in which a naval junior officer took command of a major ship and not only fought it, but sent signals as if he were admiral. He was vindicated, even though there were officers senior to him in line of command who were not even wounded. Special circumstances. A breakdown in communications. But I am thinking of a case in which 4 levels were wiped out in 6 minutes, as if a platoon leader were to blink his eyes and find himself commanding a brigade. Any of you heard of it?" Dead silence. "Very well. It was one of those bush wars that flared up on the edges of the Napoleonic Wars. This young officer was the most junior in a naval vessel. Wet navy, of course. Wind-powered, in fact. This youngster was about the age of most of your class. He was not commissioned. He carried the title of temporary third lieutenant.
Note that this is the title you are about to carry.
He had no combat experience. There were 4 officers in the chain of command above him. When the battle started, his commanding officer was wounded. The kid picked him up and carried him out of the line of fire.
That's all. Make a pickup on a comrade.
But he did it without being ordered to leave his post. The other officers all bought it while he was doing this, and he was tried for deserting his post of duty as commanding officer in the presence of the enemy. Convicted, cashiered. I gasped.
For that, sir?
Why not? True, we make pickup. We do it under different circumstances from a wet Navy battle, and by orders to the man making pickup. But pickup is never an excuse for breaking off battle in the presence of the enemy. This boy's family tried for 1.5 centuries to get his conviction reversed. No luck, of course. There was doubt about some circumstances, but no doubt that he had left his post during battle without orders. True, he was green as grass, but he was lucky not to be hanged.
Colonel Nielsen fixed me with a cold eye.
Mr. Rico, could this happen to you?
I gulped.
I hope not, sir.
Let me tell you how it could on this very Prentice cruise.
Suppose you are in a multiple ship operation with a full regiment in the drop. Officers drop first, of course. There are advantages to this and disadvantages, but we do it for reasons of morale. No trooper ever hits the ground on a hostile planet without an officer. Assume the bugs know this, and they may. Suppose they work up some trick to wipe out those who hit the ground first, but not good enough to wipe out the whole drop. Now suppose, since you are a supernumerary, you have to take any vacant capsule instead of being fired with the first wave. Where does that leave you?
I'm not sure, sir.
You have just inherited command of a regiment. What are you going to do with your command, mister? Talk fast. The bugs won't wait.
I caught an answer right out of the book and parroted it.
I'll take command and act as circumstances permit, sir, according to the tactical situation as I see it.
You will, huh? The colonel grunted. And you'll buy a farm, too. That's all anybody can do with a foul-up like that.
But I hope you'll go down swinging and shouting orders to somebody, whether they make sense or not.
We don't expect kittens to fight wildcats and win. We merely expect them to try.
All right, stand up. Put up your right hands.
He struggled to his feet.
30 seconds later, we were officers. Temporary, probationary, and supernumerary.
I thought he would give us our shoulder pips and let us go.
We aren't supposed to buy them. They're a loan, like the temporary commission they represent. Instead, he lounged back and looked almost human.
See here, lads. I gave you a talk on how rough it's going to be. I want you to worry about it. Doing it in advance, planning what steps you might take against any combination of bad news that can come your way. Keenly aware that your life belongs to your men and is not yours to throw away in a suicidal reach for glory, and that your life isn't yours to save either if the situation requires that you expend it. I want you to worry yourself sick before a drop so that you can be unruffled when the trouble starts. Impossible, of course, except for one thing. What is the only factor that can save you when the load is too heavy? Anyone?
Nobody answered.
Oh, come on,
Colonel Nielsen said scornfully. You aren't recruits. Mr. Hassan?
Your leading sergeant, sir, the assassin said slowly.
Obviously. He's probably older than you are, more drops under his belt, and he certainly knows his team better than you do. Since he isn't carrying that dreadful numbing load of top command,
He may be thinking more clearly than you are. Ask his advice. You've got one circuit just for that. It won't decrease his confidence in you. He's used to being consulted. If you don't, he'll decide you are a fool, a cocksure know-it-all. And he'll be right. But you don't have to take his advice. Whether you use his ideas or whether they spark some different plan, make your decision and snap out orders. The one thing, the only thing, that can strike terror in the heart of a good platoon sergeant is to find that he's working for a boss who can't make up his mind. There never has been an outfit in which officers and men were more dependent on each other than they are in the MI, and sergeants are the glue that holds us together. Never forget that. The commandant whipped his chair around to a cabinet near his desk. It contained row on row of pigeonholes, each with a little box. He pulled out one and opened it. Mr. Hassan?
Sir.
These pips were worn by Captain Terence O'Kelly on his Prentice cruise. Does it suit you to wear them?
Sir?
The assassin's voice squeaked, and I thought the big lunk was going to break into tears.
Yes, sir.
Come here. Colonel Nielsen pinned them on, then said, wear them gallantly, as he did, and bring them back. Understand me?
Yes, sir, I'll do my best.
I'm sure you will. There's an air car waiting on the road, and your boat boosts in 28 minutes. Carry out your orders, sir. The assassin saluted and left. The commandant turned and picked out another box.
Mr. Byrd, are you superstitious?
No, sir.
Really?
I am. Quite. I take it you would not object to wearing pips which have been worn by 5 officers, all of whom were killed in action?
Bertie barely hesitated.
No, sir.
Good, because these 5 officers accumulated 17 citations, from the Terran Metal to the Wounded Lion. Come here. The pip with the brown discoloration must always be worn on your left shoulder, and don't try to buff it off. Just try not to get the other one marked in the same fashion, unless necessary. And you'll know when it is necessary. Here is a list of former wearers. You have 30 minutes until your transportation leaves. Bounce up to Memorial Hall and look up the record of each.
Yes, sir.
Carry out your orders, sir.
He turned to me, looked at my face, and said sharply, something on your mind, son? Speak up. I blurted it out.
Sir, that temporary third lieutenant, the one that got cashiered?
How could I find out what happened?
Oh.
Young man, I didn't mean to scare the daylights out of you. I simply intended to wake you up. The battle was on 1 June 1813, old style, between USF Chesapeake and HMF Shannon. Try the Naval Encyclopedia. Your ship will have it.
He turned back to the case of pips and frowned.
Then he said, Mr. Rico, I have a letter from one of your high school teachers, a retired officer, requesting that you be issued the pips he wore as third lieutenant. I am sorry to say that I must tell him no.
Sir?
I was delighted to hear that Colonel Dubois was still keeping track of me, and very disappointed, too.
Because I can't. I issued those pips 2 years ago, and they never came back.
Real estate deal.
Hmm.
He took a box and looked at me.
You could start a new pair. The metal isn't important. The importance of the request lies in the fact that your teacher wanted you to have them.
Whatever you say, sir.
Or, he cradled the box in his hands, you could wear these. They have been worn 5 times, and the last 4 candidates to wear them have all failed of commission. Nothing dishonorable,
but pesky bad luck. Are you willing to take a swing at breaking the hoodoo? Turn them into good luck pips instead?
I would rather have petted a shark.
But I answered, All right, sir, I'll take a swing at it.
Good.
He pinned them on me.
Thank you, Mr. Rico.
You see, these were mine. I wore them first. And it would please me mightily to have them brought back to me with that streak of bad luck broken.
Have you go on and graduate?
I felt 10 feet tall.
I'll try, sir.
I know you will. You may now carry out your orders, sir. The same air car will take both you and Bird.
Just a moment.
Are your mathematics textbooks in your bag?
Sir? No, sir.
Get them. The weightmaster of your ship has been advised of your extra baggage allowance. I saluted and left, on the bounce. He had me shrunk down to size as soon as he had mentioned math. My math books were on my study desk, tied into a package with a daily assignment sheet tucked under the cord. I gathered the impression that Colonel Nielsen never left anything unplanned, but everybody knew that. Bertie was waiting on the roof by the air car. He glanced at my books and grinned. Too bad. Well, if we're in the same ship, I'll coach you.
What ship?
Tours.
Sorry, I'm for the Moskva.
We got in, I checked the pilot, saw that it had been preset for the field, closed the door and the car took off.
Bertie added,
You could be worse off. The assassin took not only his math books, but two other subjects. Bertie undoubtedly knew that he had not been showing off when he offered to coach me. He was a professor type, except that his ribbons proved that he was a soldier, too. Instead of studying math, Bertie taught it. One period each day, he was a faculty member, the way little Sujumi taught judo at Camp Curie. The MI doesn't waste anything. We can't afford to. Bertie had a BS in math on his 18th birthday. So, naturally, he was assigned extra duty as instructor, which didn't keep him from being chewed out at other times. Not that he got chewed out much. Bertie had that rare combo of brilliant intellect, solid education, common sense, and guts, which gets a cadet marked as potential general. We figured he was a cinch to command a brigade by the time he was 30. What with a war. But my ambitions didn't soar that high. It would be a dirty, rotten shame, I said, if the assassin flunked out, while thinking that it would be a dirty, rotten shame if I flunked out. He won't, Bertie answered cheerfully. They'll sweat him through the rest, if they have to put him in a hypno booth and feed him through a tube. Anyhow, he added, Hassan could flunk out and get promoted for it.
Huh?
Didn't you know? The assassin's permanent rank is first lieutenant, field commission, naturally. He reverts to it if he flunks out. See the regs?
I knew the regs. If I flunked math, I'd revert to buck sergeant, which is better than being slapped in the face with a wet fish any way you think about it. And I had thought about it, lying awake nights after busting a quiz.
But this is different.
Hold it, I protested. He gave up first lieutenant, permanent grade, and has just made temporary third lieutenant?
In order to become a second lieutenant?
Are you crazy? Or is he?
Bertie grinned. Just enough to make us both MI.
But I don't get it.
Sure you do. The assassin has no education that he didn't pick up in the MI. So how high can he go? I'm sure he could command a regiment in battle and do a real swinging job, provided somebody else planned the operation. But commanding in battle is only a fraction of what an officer does, especially a senior officer. To direct a war, or even to plan a single battle and mount the operation, you have to have theory of games, operational analysis, symbolic logic, pessimistic synthesis, and a dozen other skull subjects. You can sweat them out on your own if you've got the grounding, but have them you must, or you'll never get past captain, or possibly major. The assassin knows what he is doing.
I suppose so, I said slowly. Bertie, Colonel Nielsen must know that Hassan was an officer. Is an officer, really.
Huh?
Of course.
He didn't talk as if he knew. We all got the same lecture.
Not quite. Did you notice that when the commandant wanted a question answered a particular way, he always asked the assassin?
I decided it was true.
Bertie, what is your permanent rank?
The car was just landing. He paused with a hand on the latch and grinned.
PFC. I don't dare flunk out.
I snorted.
You won't. You can't.
I was surprised that he wasn't even a corporal, but a kid as smart and well-educated as Bertie would go to the OCS just as quickly as he proved himself in combat, which, with a war on, could be only months after his 18th birthday.
Bertie grinned still wider.
We'll see.
You'll graduate. Hassan and I had to worry, but not you.
So? Suppose Miss Kendrick takes a dislike to me.
He opened the door and looked startled.
Hey, they're sounding my call. So long.
See you, Bertie.
But I didn't see him, and he did not graduate. He was commissioned 2 weeks later, and his pips came back with their 18th decoration. The Wounded Lion, posthumous.